Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dot Foil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking about wild horses. I'd like now to welcome to the program Gene Henley. He is Associate Director of the University of New Mexico School of Public Administration, and Billy Blair, who is former president of the Santa Fe Community Foundation. She's a visiting lecturer at the UNM School of Public Administration. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having us.
Good to see you this morning.
It's great to see you, too. Now, there is an event coming up this Friday, which is the occasion of our conversation today, from 9 to 4 at the Santa Fe Community College, and it is about something that I'm sure is pressing on many people's minds. It's a conference called Legislative Outlook 2011, Understanding the Budget. So what's that all about? What's this budget conference about?
It's a great opportunity for people to come and learn about how the budget process works and what the policies are and what the prospects for the 2011 budget are going to be. We're very excited because we're going to have with us the new incoming Secretary of the Department of Finance and Administration, Richard May, and he's going to give the new governor's perspective. We'll also hear the legislative side of that, and we're going to have presentations from key members of the Legislative Finance Committee agency staff.
Now, the budget, as we've talked about on this program, is a very big problem and very big question this year because we've got such a huge shortfall.
We do, and it depends on who you talk to.
How much that shortfall is.
That's what we expect to hear on Friday at 9 o'clock at the Santa Fe Community College, because the executive estimates are that this shortfall is about $450 million, or as I sometimes like to round it up to almost $500 million.
In a state of 2 million people.
And the legislative folks are saying it's about $257 million. What's going to be timely about this is that David Abbey, who is the director of the Legislative Council Service, is going to come directly from a press conference revealing that budget to our conference. And so they are going to have the freshest numbers that day.
So beyond the numbers, what is required to, we've got this huge number that's sort of staggering and scary. How do we understand that? How do we understand what can be done about it? What do you do in a conference of this kind?
Well, I think first of all, you have to understand that a budget is a statement of policy. It's a statement of priorities. And so when you'll hear from the legislative side or from the executive side, you're going to hear what their priorities are for the coming fiscal year. Part of what this conference is hoping to do is to share that information with people that are interested in these topics, give them a little bit of insight as to how decisions are going to be made, and to some extent, how those are going to impact various constituencies. Regardless of how large the deficit is, the numbers are staggering, and a lot of the easy cuts have been made over the last year and year or two. So now we're really getting down to some hard choices, and it's going to be very important to see where the priorities in education, where the priorities in health care, where the priorities in the size of government, how those are going to be viewed by both the executive and the legislative branch.
As we've talked about a little bit on this program, just the simple act of repealing Richardson's tax cuts would get rid of the budget deficit entirely. Is that correct? Some number close to that.
Depending on how, yes, the answer is it appears that the size of those tax cuts would have some impact, a significant impact, if not a large impact on the size of the deficit. But as with every other decision, there are pros and cons to tax cuts or tax increases, and so both political parties and both the legislative and the executive are going to have varying points of view on that, and it's going to take time to build a coalition, just like it took time to build a coalition to cut the taxes.
What do you see so far as the priorities of the new administration, and what is their role compared to the legislature in forming and crafting the budget?
Well, to be quite frank, that's exactly what we're hoping to find out on Friday. The secretary designate is one of the lead spokespeople for the administration's policies on finance. And so we hope to hear from him what this particular administration is, what their goals are. And so
So we don't know yet.
The short answer is yes, we don't know.
And not only that, but Mary Charlotte, when you're talking about changing, increasing revenue sources and so forth, we're going to be hearing from key members, key legislative members of the Legislative Finance Committee. We're going to be hearing from Senator Sue Wilson-Beffert. We're going to hear from Representative Lucky Varela. And we've asked them to address, one's a Republican, one's a Democrat, to address what types of measures they've considered as they've been having committee meetings all year long, the end of last year. What have they considered? Have they considered any new sources of revenue? And what are they most likely to do in funding key needs in New Mexico?
Let's talk about what some of those needs in New Mexico are. I mean, this is a very poor state with a large rural population and then sort of little centers of wealth like Los Alamos and Santa Fe within this huge state. What kind of services are considered absolutely essential to the most vulnerable people of this state?
Well, I think if you look at the way the budget is put together now, the state of New Mexico has put its money in education and in health care, and those two by far are the largest components of the budget. So I think the state has set its priorities in those areas, whether it's in P through 20 in education, or whether it's in Medicaid, Medicare, whether it's in preventative health care, what have you. You know, the vast majority of our budget goes to those things. And so part of crafting a budget is much more than just revenues. It's also determining to some extent what are not just the priorities, but how you're going to determine which things are going to be funded. Lucky Varela had a task force that he was responsible for over the last year, which is looking at government restructuring. That's one thing that they're looking to see if there are ways to consolidate. There are ways to combine functions, become more efficient, if you will.
And is that really expected to have a very large impact on the budget?
I don't know if it has a significant dollar impact, but I think it has a significant psychological impact in terms of, I mean, it's kind of easy to say the government is inefficient or government is too large. Those are simple terms, but when you really get down to how many people are actually doing a particular function, as you said, we're a large state and we're a poor state and we're a rural state. So you're not going to go from 33 offices of a particular agency to less, because you need at least one in most of the counties just to be able to reach out to service those. We can't be compared to a California or to an Illinois that have large metropolitan areas. You take Albuquerque and the Rio Grande Corridor out of the mix, you still have a lot of estate. Okay, and so I think what needs to be looked at to some extent is how can we best provide the services that the state deems important, whether it's in health, whether it's in education. And so between what Representative Varela is working on and many other people that are interested in segments of this discussion, whether it's in higher education in terms of having a discussion on the number of four-year universities and community colleges that we have in the state. And, of course, you hear the discussion about comparing us to Arizona, for example. Well, I find those interesting as starting points, but they're really apples and oranges.
Tell us what you mean by the discussions of comparing us to Arizona.
The Arizona university system, I believe, has two major universities, and then there are some community colleges or two-year schools. With a population several times larger than ours, they have quite a few less institutions than we do. And so some people are saying, well, that's the way to solve the problem. Just close, you know, some of the other campuses around the state. We don't need that many. Well, I'm not in a position to say whether that's a good thing or not, but I think you can't make it that simple that you just compare one state to another, see how many state employees you have per 1,000 or how many schools you have per whatever it is. I think you need to do a deeper analysis of that.
Like, how are Arizonans doing? Are they healthy? Are they educated?
There are many benchmarks that need to be considered into the discussion, and that's what the budget process brings about, having the time to go through those things and discuss them in a setting where different opinions are going to be presented, where different constituencies are going to be presenting their thoughts on it, and then hopefully when you finish that process, there's some kind of a consensus that the legislature and the executive can come to an agreement on, and that's how you end up with the budget.
We're talking to Gene Henley and Billy Blair from the UNM School of Public Administration. And once again, the conference this coming Friday is called Legislative Outlook 2011, Understanding the Budget. It's from 8:30 to 4 in the afternoon at the Santa Fe Community College. I did a calculation where if every working family, I mean, excluding unemployed people, paid approximately $10 to $20 per month per working family, all of our budget problems would be solved. Okay, there's political problems with that because nobody wants to talk about taxes, but there is on the agenda here this thing called severance tax. What is that? What's severance tax?
The severance tax funds and several other funds were created several decades ago. When the state of New Mexico became a state, the lands that were given to the state government by the federal government are lands that were kept in trust. The proceeds from the royalties, whether it's from oil and gas, which go into one fund, or some leasing of lands, those monies were kept. And I really applaud the leaderships of the legislature and the executive back in the 50s and earlier for having the foresight to keep those monies in safeguarding them in perpetuity. Other states like Alaska, they give that money back to their people every year, and they spend it. Well, the people that we had in government back then had vision. And what they could see was at some point those monies from the extractive industries or other sources would disappear, you know, and then we as a state would be left with nothing to help fund these things. And so the severance tax fund and several of these others over a period of time have been constitutionally protected from being able to be spent. Now,
are they just being invested right now? How are they being? What is the state of these monies right now?
Well, the monies are invested, and the interest and the proceeds are what are used to fund, in large measure, education and a lot of other things in government. And so we as a state will always have that large body of money, the corpus, for our future. Now there are some in the legislature and in others in other areas that say those were rainy day funds and we are in a rainy day situation, now they should be spent. And then there are others that would say, no, that's not what we should be doing. And so one of the first philosophical debates is going to be what should or could happen to the severance tax fund. I believe that Senator Sanchez has considered the idea of tapping into those funds to help get us through these difficult times. I don't pretend to know what the next 60 days is going to bring, but there are clearly folks that think now is the time that we should be, instead of cutting things, finding other sources of revenue, and that's one of them.
And that's one of them.
And it's anticipated that Senator Sanchez will introduce the same bill he introduced in last session, which would permit the Secretary of DFA to pledge up to $300 million in severance tax funds to the general fund.
DFA?
Yes, Secretary of Department of Finance and Administration. So that is a way that gets to the number you were citing earlier to get to that number. So as part of our conference, and I think it's going to be very exciting in the afternoon when people tend to get a little sluggish, we're going to have Senator Jerry Ortiz Pino from Albuquerque and Representative Tom Taylor from Farmington have a gentlemanly debate on that topic. And Senator Ortiz Pino is for using the severance tax funds, and Representative Taylor is against it. And they are both very interesting people and very gentlemanly, and I think it'll be a good discussion for our attendees.
One of the problems with the whole game of politics is that elected officials are elected for a very short time, 2 years to 4 years, whereas some of the problems that a state like New Mexico or any state faces is how to make long-term investments in the infrastructure, in the educational system, and so on. And so the benefits, for example, pre-kindergarten, that's something that's been talked about a great deal. The benefits that you see from having pre-kindergarten programs don't really come out for another 15 or 20 years or more. And there's a lot of things like that. How do you get politicians to do things that aren't going to reflect well on them or even come to fruition in the short term?
Well, I think part of it is that we have to educate the population. People have to become aware of, you know, of the value of these investments, as opposed to, the easy way of just, making purchases, if you will. Our population needs to, to spend a little bit more time, in my opinion, learning a little bit about the budget process, learning a little bit about the political process, and probably learning a little bit about how decisions are made, and that way they can have these kinds of discussions with their elected officials, and share with them that they're interested in more than just short-term solutions to long-term problems. They would like to see them addressed. On the national level, you see this beginning to happen with the deficit finally. That discussion's been going on 20 some odd years, but now it seems to be that people are seriously concerned about the size of that, and it seems to be driving some of the national agendas. Well, I think the same kind of thing is going to be happening at the local levels, whether it's in this short-term situation or it's going to be in more structural issues such as education or some of health care, what have you. People are getting to the point where they're more concerned about the long-term effects than they are just the short-term impacts on their pocketbook or on their particular issues.
And that's true for the people, but at the same time, there's not a built-in incentive for their elected officials to act on that.
There will always be some elected officials that are more interested in the politics. But I truly believe that most elected officials are interested in doing a good job for their constituents, as they see it. And so part of what the process should be is to inform your legislators of what your wishes are. And if enough people did that, then they would respond to those issues as opposed to, people who have strong opinions are not shy about voicing them. Okay, what I think sometimes is helpful are those that have little interest in something getting involved and providing their input, and a lot of times that's going to be enough to alter the political calculus.
In fact, legislators do listen to their constituents, and that's precisely what this conference is designed to do, is to educate constituents. You asked earlier who should attend. Well, anybody. It should be government employees, nonprofit executives, students, the general public, because it will really give people a vision of what the budget process is and how they can affect it, and also to understand about the severance tax funds.
We're talking to Billy Blair and Gene Henley from the UNM School of Public Administration. If there's one thing that I could do, everybody talks about education, is reinstate civics classes. at various levels so that this kind of thing just didn't happen on the radio cafe, but it happened in school, and people would get excited and take field trips to the legislature when they were young and realize that they, from the early stage, because I think a lot of people are just inexperienced and just downright shy of making that first phone call or getting their butts down to the roundhouse and getting involved.
I would completely agree that a civics course should be a required course, in my opinion. As with anything else in life, if you don't have an understanding of it, you really can't participate. And I find that most people really don't have an understanding or an appreciation for what politics are, except for what they see every 2 years or 4 years. And I think if most people, if that's their only understanding or exposure to politics, I can easily see why they'd be turned off.
Let's talk for a moment about the UNM School of Public Administration. What do you do there? What do you teach? What's it all about?
Well, the School of Public Administration is one of the oldest schools of public administration in the country. We recently celebrated our 40th anniversary last year. And what the School of Public Administration does for the state of New Mexico is to help train and educate professional administrators and managers. And one of the things that I'm most proud of is that a little over 70% of all of our graduates stay in New Mexico. So they go back to their communities throughout New Mexico, and they serve on the state level. They serve on the local level. They serve in our Native American communities. They serve in our nonprofits. You'll find our alums throughout New Mexico. And I think that as society gets more complex, the problems become more difficult to solve, and it requires trained professionals to be able to administer things. And part of what our job is to do is to get them prepared to lead and to manage organizations, departments, divisions, what have you.
I think it cannot be understated, or it cannot be overstated, how important good administrators are. They can be real unsung heroes running an efficient department at a county or state or local level that actually administers services in a way that is responsive to the people. It's not something that you give people a medal for. You only complain about it when it's done badly, but when it's done well, it seems like that's just the way things always have been. But in fact, it takes a whole lot of training to do that.
Yes, it does, and it's becoming more and more critical to have that, especially if government is going to be made smaller, then it has to become more efficient. It has to be led by people that that are trained to get the most out of the dollars that the taxpayers give us.
Billy, what are you doing? You're a visiting lecturer at the School of Public Administration.
Well, this is the first of a series of conferences we're going to have here in Santa Fe this year. And so what I'm doing is organizing these conferences. We're going to have subsequent ones on, we think, don't hold us to this, cost-cut management, because we anticipate that what will happen after this legislative session is that a lot of administrators will be given their marching orders on cutting expenses. And there are strategic and smart ways to do that. It's not necessarily just saying, okay, everybody's going to take a 10% salary cut, or okay, we're going to have a furlough. So I think that'll be of interest not just to people in government, but to people in private business. We're also looking at doing another conference on this issue Gene was speaking of earlier, on education funding. What can we support in New Mexico, considering how many students we have and how many institutions of higher learning we have in New Mexico?
Very interesting. Well, this is all happening sponsored by the University of New Mexico School of Public Administration. And once again, Legislative Outlook 2011, Understanding the Budget, is a conference happening at the Santa Fe Community College Hemez Rooms this Friday from 8:30 in the morning till 4 in the afternoon. If you want more information, you can call 505-277-6038 and talk to Sherry. And if you want to register, you can call 505-277-0077, or you can just visit on the web dce.unm.edu. Jean Henley is Associate Director of the UNM School of Public Administration. Billy Blair is visiting lecturer there. Thank you both so much for being on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Jacqueline Fleming. She is founder of the Cimarron Sky Dog Reserve, and James Anaquad Kleinart. He's a filmmaker, and his new film is called Wild Horses and Renegades. And there is an event this coming Friday, a very big event, at the Collected Works Bookstore at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, Friday the 7th of January. There is a photo contest, reception, book signing, and the film Wild Horses and Renegades will be shown at 7 o'clock. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So let's talk about the Sky Dog Reserve. What's it all about?
It's a 501c3 wild horse sanctuary. I basically provide a home for as many wild horses as I can possibly afford to take in land-wise and money-wise. I have 23 horses right now. We have 420 acres of open land up on at Watrous, which is just north of Las Vegas. And then we have a main headquarters, which is on 50 acres down near Cerrillos in the Galisteo Basin.
And where did these horses come from?
Some are from the Jicarilla Wild Horse Territory here in New Mexico and El Rito here in New Mexico. And last year, I guess I could say last year now that it's 2011, I got 7 from BLM pens in Oklahoma. And some of those are from Nevada and some of those are from Wyoming. So it's a mixed bunch.
And how did they come to you?
Well, they've all got a story behind them. Most of them I've gone and adopted from the adoptions they hold. Either in New Mexico or there's many adoption facilities around the country. The first wild horse was kind of just an accident, really. Somebody called me up because I had a horse sanctuary, and they said there's a mare about to be shipped off. Nobody's adopted her. She has a baby. Do you have a place for her? And I said, sure. And I went and picked her up. And I mean, she was very, very skinny. She'd come off the range. They'd had a very, very hard winter that winter, so all the horses that they had there were kind of skinny, and then she gave birth right after that. And so I brought them home, and she's just a darling, and her little baby is now 4 years old, and that got me hooked on concentrating on the wild horses. And
what's the difference between a wild horse and a domestic horse?
Well, these are wild horses that have come off wild territory. They haven't come out of somebody's breeding barn. So they've been running free, sometimes for generations they've been running free. And so when they're caught, they've had no handling by humans at all.
And the idea is to keep it that way?
In my case, yes. Although these guys have all gotten used to me, and we have visitors come to the sanctuary. A lot of photographers come and photograph our horses, and these guys don't run away. A lot of times you have to hold on to your bags and belongings because they get curious. And
they'll run away, they'll purse snatch you?
Yeah, they'll purse snatch you and take your hat off and things like that. And that's just because they've gotten used to having people around. It's not because we've worked with them or tried to train them, or they've just learned to trust us because nobody's ever treated them badly at our place. So.
It's not like you ride them or anything like that?
No, and I have no. Last year we did a project with a young guy called Parker Flannery, who is a trainer with the Mustang Heritage Foundation. He and some buddies had wanted to ride up the Continental Divide on horses, and Parker wanted to take Mustangs, and so I got involved with that. And in the end, ultimately, he took one of my recently adopted Mustangs from Oklahoma. She's a Nevada horse, and I adopted her from Oklahoma. And within 2 months, he had her as a pack horse, and she did 1,000 miles up the Rocky Mountains. And I joined them for a week, which is nothing like what they did. But I was trying to get it on film and make some kind of document it in some way to prove that these horses, although I don't need them to be riding horses, most people who are going to be adopting horses need to have something they can ultimately use. So it was kind of done, from my perspective anyway, to show that these are very trainable horses if you require that.
Now, when you have a wild horse sanctuary, as you do, and of course you're always looking for more land, which has the dual purpose of having a place, a habitat for these horses, and also keeping the land from being developed.
Yes.
How do you find the right number of horses for that, for the amount of land that you have, and how do you keep that number stable?
Well, there's a lot of different numbers out there, but horses, especially if it's not irrigated land and it's not a rainy climate, so we're talking, you know, this wild New Mexico land fits both of those bills. I think it's something like 60 or 70 acres per horse.
Okay.
For year-round grazing. So it may even be more than that to keep the land healthy. And of course, you've got to factor for probably, if you're going to do it right, for the worst-case scenario rather than the best-case scenario. So my horses are only on our 420 acres for half the year. And normally they come back down to Cerrillos for the winter, but I found a lease for 1,000 acres this winter, so I just moved them over onto 1,000 acres. So they're still running free this winter. So if we could do that every year, that would be terrific. We would personally love to own the land, but that takes a lot of funds to do that. And all the land around us is for sale, and we're terrified it's going to become housing. That's a lot of my motivation to want to buy it, is just to keep it wild.
Well, and keeping it wild, you're doing it for the horses, but there's also real benefits for the watersheds, for wildlife corridors, for all kinds of wildlife habitat.
Absolutely. There are so many elk that come across, back and forth across that land. And you'll see masses, like 80, 90 elk, that they jump off fence. I got it on film one time, a couple of falls ago, should I say. I just arrived at the property, and about 80 elk jumped the fence onto my property, and the horses took one look at them and galloped up to join them. And from long distance, sadly, I filmed the horses running with the elk, and then they all disappeared up the hill, and I was on foot. So by the time I managed to catch up with them, the action was over, but it was an amazing sight. But definitely, there are a lot of elk that have been going back and forth across that land, because that land up there is unchanged, completely unchanged. I mean, the most that's changed is there's no buffalo anymore and there are a few fences, but there's absolutely no change to what it was hundreds of years ago. So
we're talking to Jacqueline Fleming and James Anaquad Kleinert. James, let's talk about your film Wild Horses and Renegades, which is screening this Friday at Collected Works. It's also screening next week. We'll talk about that in a moment. But you made this film in part to counter some real misconceptions that people have about wild horses.
Yeah, that was one of the motivations, was to set the record straight. The BLM is really misleading the public on a lot of things that they're saying.
How
press
so?
Releases. For example, the numbers. There's a new report out. It's been released to Congress by an independent group, Cindy MacDonald. She's a very well-known independent person who's been studying and getting all of BLM's numbers that they publish in each of their offices throughout the American West. Also, Dr. Carolyn Bates. She's a professor at the University of Southern California. And they've come up that wild horses will go extinct in the next 11 years if BLM continues on the current track of removal and elimination of America's wild horses. I've spent extensive years in the wild documenting them, and the numbers never add up. They'll say there's X amount of numbers out there, but if you go out in the field with a camera and if you spend time on horseback hiking around and looking, you'll never find the numbers that they're saying are out there.
So they're inflating the numbers of wild horses that are out there.
Yes, they are.
What is their agenda?
Well, I think if you really want to look at what's behind most of this, you can look at the corruption within the Department of the Interior, Minerals Management, which is a division that the investigator, the OIG investigator, they found a lot of corruption within the department, employees taking bribes from oil and gas mining companies, prostitutes. A lot of this goes to the Abramoff affair, which has been now very much exposed by a documentary film and now the feature film Casino Jack. The Department of the Interior, Bureau of Land Management, they're required to do environmental impact statements before they allow drilling or mining operations to come in and extract. Under the Bush administration, this is continuing now under the Obama administration, they're going in and they're extracting under what are called categorical exclusions. They're bypassing environmental impact statements. Best example is the Deepwater Horizon. That was put in under categorical exclusions. They completely bypassed the permitting process that they're supposed to go through. you know, the regulations, safety measures that are put into these extraction companies. So what we're seeing now in the American West is a massive takeover of our public lands by oil, gas, and mining operations. In the Bush administration, over 30 million acres, that's 15 Yellowstone National Parks, have been leased to oil, gas, and mining companies. As you'll see in my film, Wild Horses and Renegades, we document the Disappointment Valley herd management area. They came in and they reduced that herd from roughly 120 wild horses down to 37 wild horses. 6 months after the horses were removed, they put in 120 uranium mining claims by foreign investors. So they're really selling off our public lands to the highest bidder. That's what's going on.
And so the detriment that we suffer as the public is the elimination of wild horses, but it's much more than that.
It is. It's much more than just wild horses. There's other wildlife species out there. There's also just the health and well-being of the land itself. In so many of these cases, the extractive industries pollute, for example, groundwater, that type of thing. You know, we feature a number of different people in the film who tell personal stories of what they've witnessed, what's happened to the land. So it's another American tragedy that's unfolding here in the American West. And, you know, we're not saying that, no, there shouldn't be extractive industries. You know, we talk about these companies and these big corporations that are coming in and doing this, being responsible and hopefully doing things in an ecological manner rather than what we're seeing now, which is a lot of raping and pillaging. And the wild horses is the best example of that.
We're talking to James Anaquad Kleinert about his film Wild Horses and Renegades, and Jacqueline Fleming about her Cimarron Sky Dog Reserve. There was a near victory for a state wild horse preserve. Tell us about that.
Well, they had a great idea on the table here in New Mexico. They wanted to buy 12,000 acres down by Madrid. And
my neighborhood, yeah.
It would have been beautiful, unfortunately.
And it was approved, and at the very last minute, for budget reasons, was withdrawn?
Yeah. As you know, the state deficit is very high. I actually had a personal meeting with Governor Richardson. I delivered him hundreds of letters written on behalf of the voters of New Mexico and the American people supporting it. Public support was overwhelming for it. But as we know, the state is in a very tough position right now economically. So they decided not to spend the money. I think it's great, though, that people like Jacqueline and other people are creating private preserves. They're giving horses an out that otherwise may end up at slaughter, wild horses. So it's great that the public is stepping up. I think we need more of this, though, and hopefully we'll see philanthropists and people like that stepping up and helping to save America's wild horses. There's over 40,000 wild horses in government holding facilities right now. We, the U.S. taxpayers, we're spending $120,000 a day to feed these horses in holding facilities.
When they could be out on the land,
right,
feeding themselves.
We advocate in the wild management. This can be done very cost effectively, and it can employ Americans. Right now, they're stockpiling and warehousing these horses.
And they're suffering, presumably, if they're not running free.
Many of these facilities are overcrowded. They're like prisons. And the horses don't have a place to exercise. They're crammed in small places. We're seeing instances where the horses are getting sick. Strangles is a big problem because their living conditions aren't sanitary. And then many of them slip out the back door to slaughter.
I went to, with that project I was talking about with Parker Flannery, I went to one of the facilities in Oklahoma twice to film him pick out horses, and then I ended up bringing 7 home myself. But there were 500 horses alone in that one facility, and that's a lot of horses. You have to sort of see it to believe it. Now, some were in fields, but most of them were in pens. And it's pretty heartbreaking, especially given that these horses know what freedom is.
Exactly.
If a horse doesn't know what freedom is, it's not really knowing what it's missing. But if these horses have been their own boss and run free and been able to dictate what they do that day, and all of a sudden they haven't got one decision they can make for themselves, it's pretty heartbreaking. You can probably tell I'm English. I grew up around the world, and there are wild horses in many countries around the world, but the most famous wild horse that everybody's ever heard of is the Mustang,
right,
more than any other wild horse. And in America, defends its freedom with wars. They're fighting words, and yet this one animal that is a symbol of freedom is having to work so hard, or where people are having to work so hard to keep it free. And it's just ironic that this is this symbol of freedom. Most of them aren't free anymore.
Right. To what extent are philanthropists stepping up to, essentially, I mean, I think the important thing is buy land, give these horses a place to run. To what extent is that happening in the face of this missed opportunity, among many others, for the state to step up?
You could probably answer that one better than me. You've probably met a lot more people than I have doing that.
Well, for example, you have the Cloud Foundation, Ginger Catherine's. Ginger's
right.
featured in my film. She's also a documentary filmmaker who's done the series Cloud, Wild Stallion of the Rockies, that's been on PBS's Nature.
Mm-hmm.
They have rescued a number of horses that were taken off the prior wild horse range up in Montana. They've created a sanctuary there. That's an example. We're seeing a lot of groups like that, smaller grassroots groups, do this. It's really important people get involved with these organizations. If you want to take part, you know, they do have membership, and it's a good thing.
And sponsorship. You can help by sponsoring one of the horses.
Can you?
So you don't actually have to take it home and put it in your backyard.
Right,
but
right.
You can help feed it and make it up its costs. Mm-hmm. That's something that we try to have people do.
And then there's the biggest story on this is Madeline Pickens, wife of T. Boone Pickens, the Texas billionaire. Madeline has purchased around 1 million acres in Nevada. She is working with the BLM to hopefully relocate a lot of those horses that are long-term holding up to that facility. It's my understanding the BLM has said they will give her 1,500 horses. That's a very small number compared to what they have in holding. So hopefully they'll cooperate with her more. I know Madeline has had somewhat of a bit of a difficult time working with the BLM. She's come forward and offered a lot of resources, a lot of solutions, and they have been dragging their feet on this. But hopefully they're going to give her and this Wild Horse Preserve an opportunity to provide a solution.
It is... it's quite a sad thing when given the opportunity to do a good thing for free, people still don't do it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, what's the best is that if you can have it where you can actually have it where they're still completely wild, where they can still have some babies, you know, and they can live as wild herds with stallions and things like that. And I think that requires the wild or a massive sanctuary to be able to accommodate that. We don't have breeding at our sanctuary. We don't have any stallions, just because I'd rather keep a space for a horse that's in a pen and provide it freedom than breed new ones.
Right.
Even though I'm a sucker for a baby horse just like anybody else. And we have had babies because a lot of the mares that are rounded up are already pregnant. So we've had babies where the mare gave birth because she was, she got pregnant in the wild. But we do need wild places. If you want to observe horses as wild horses and different bands and breeding and stallions fighting and all of that stuff, you really need to have a wild place where horses can be truly wild. And it's too bad it's not in the wild territories we have already.
And, I want to back that up and say, you know, we really need to advocate keeping these few horses that are left in the wild. So it's really important for people to call President Obama. You can go to whitehouse.gov. You can call President Obama, demand a moratorium be placed on all roundup and removals. What a moratorium means, it's a timeout. We're asking that they take a timeout on all of the roundup and removals. They study the situation. They get the real numbers, the real facts. My film has a lot of people stepping forward and exposing the truth. Hopefully my film will be used in a congressional investigation into the Bureau of Land Management. They have been completely and totally manipulating their numbers and lying to Congress, lying to the Senate, lying to the President. And so something really needs to be done on this, and not only regarding wild horses, but the health and well-being of our public lands. So please, people, get active on this issue. Also contact Senator Bingaman's office here in New Mexico. Senator Bingaman heads the Senate Committee on Energy and Natural Resources. He's a very influential person on this. This is also, it's a bipartisan issue. The ROMAC passed unanimously in the House of Representatives
this past year.
It's Restore Our American Mustang Act. It passed it passed overwhelmingly,
yeah.
Excuse me. So both Republicans and Democrats support this bill. It's sitting in a Senate committee. If it gets out of committee and moves to the Senate floor, it will pass. Again, we know there's enough senators in both parties that will vote in favor of it. So this is a real opportunity to save the horses, but please put pressure on Senator Bingaman. Call him and have him move that bill out of committee.
The Cimarron Sky Dog Reserve, why is it called Sky Dog?
Sky Dog is one of a Native Americans were named for a horse. I'm sure you probably know about that as well, right?
I don't know this story.
You don't? Well, I mean, from what I've learned from reading books and stuff, the horse to the Native Americans was, when they first saw it, when it came back into America, and the Spanish brought the horses back, they didn't really know what they were looking at. And they thought it was a massive dog. And
so it's called a Sky Dog.
Well, sent to them by Father Sky.
Ah.
And it comes, there are other versions of that, like God Dog, Sky Dog, and Holy Dog. But to them,
Shunko Wakan, which means sacred dog,
okay,
or sacred wolf in Lakota.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Jacqueline Fleming is founder of the Cimarron Sky Dog Reserve, which is at cimarronskydog.org. James Anaquad Kleinert is a filmmaker, and his film Wild Horses and Renegades is screening at Collected Works Bookstore at 7 in the evening.
Yeah, Wild Horses and Renegades, we have an amazing cast. We have Willie Nelson, Sheryl Crow, Viggo Mortensen, who starred in the film Hidalgo, well-known New Mexican actor Raul Trujillo, also Daryl Hannah. We have Scott Momaday, Pulitzer Prize-winning American Indian author. We have Michael Blake, who wrote Dances with Wolves. That's just a few of the people. Jim Baca, a New Mexican resident who is a director of the Bureau of Land Management under President Clinton. Amazing cast of people speaking out about this issue. You're going to hear from a lot of very credible and respected people. This is a very real film on what's happening to America's wild horses. So I really hope people will come out and see the tragedy that's occurring on our watch.
And it's also screening at the NIA Dance Studio on San Mateo on Saturday, the 15th of January. His website is theamericanwildhorse.com. And there will also be a photography reception and book signing with Tony Stromberg, Lynn Pomerantz, Greg Albrecht, and you, Jacqueline. And this starts at 5 o'clock on this Friday.
We wanted to do a fundraising event, so we did a photography contest. We had two categories, but it's a fundraising event, and we're showing the winning photographs, along with photographs by Tony Stromberg and Lynn Pomerantz and Greg Albrecht, and a book signing as well.
And a book signing. And so there are also some horses in need of adoption.
Yes. In Farmington, there are 30 Jicarilla wild horses up for adoption. If they don't get adopted, they have nowhere to go. The BLM pens are full. So I do not know what's going to happen to these horses if they don't get adopted.
If anyone wants to adopt a wild horse,
this is the time. And you can get a New Mexico one that comes from New Mexico and go see them. If you're interested, we have a link to that adoption site on our website on the Wild Horse Rescue page.
CimarronSkyDog.org. Jacqueline and James, thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at KSFR.org, podcasting at SantaFeRadioCafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at Facebook.com/Radio Cafe. And my email address is radiocafe@KSFR.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.